The recession is forcing us to learn to network.
You have to sort of put a little bit of effort into bringing up what you do.
There's a growing freelance economy, and we've got some tips to help you succeed. Plus, firsthand accounts of the lingering effects of disasters. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. November's Atlantic Magazine had an article on Freelancers Union founder Sarah Horowitz, and it describes freelancers as the fastest growing segment of the economy. Whether they're writers, programmers, sound engineers, or designers, there's a growing group of workers who don't have bosses, they have clients. Mia Lobel of New York's Hudson Valley is one of those professional freelancers. She's a journalist and audio producer and the founder of FreelanceCafe.org, a networking site for freelancers where they share war stories, ideas, and gig opportunities.
I always kind of run into issues with people telling me what to do, I guess, for lack of a better word. I'm very independent-minded and very, you know, I work really hard. I kind of like to do things on my own terms. And so after that, I actually ended up, I had a lot of debt after grad school, and I wasn't making very much money at Youth Radio at all. So when that ended, I tried freelancing for a short time, and it wasn't really working out. I wasn't doing it right. I was very young. I had very few contacts, and I just couldn't make ends meet, so I ended up getting a job in Silicon Valley for the next 4 years, doing audio production, but not journalism at all. I basically missed the journalism aspect of it, and I kind of ran into those same issues of you know, having to do what somebody else wanted me to do as opposed to what I could, you know, do on my own. So, after about 4 years, I basically just decided to make another go of it. I had earned enough money while I was working for this company to, you know, give myself a little bit of a barrier to try to get my freelance career up and running. Started this freelancer network just to keep myself kind of in the fold with my colleagues, which is something that I really missed the first time around. I just got so lonely. And then I also managed to get a regular client that sort of allowed the rest of my work to kind of fall into place after that. And I actually still have that client. They're still my kind of the bread and butter of my freelance career. And then I have all these other projects that kind of come and go from that.
Do you feel like you did something different that got you your bread and butter client?
You know, I think I was a little bit lucky, but that job actually came out of the networking that I was doing the second time around. So I created this, I call it Freelance Cafe, basically just this network of freelancers that I would meet with and socialize and hang out with and also just communicate with regularly about the kind of work they were doing and, you know, what issues people were running into and all that stuff. And through one of the people who was involved in that, I found out that this nonprofit organization in Philadelphia wanted a podcast. And so I just kind of threw my name in the hat and ended up getting that client. I did, in a way, make it possible for it to happen in a way that the first time around I had nothing. You know, I felt like I was just sitting around my apartment waiting for the phone to ring, and that's not the way to that's not the way to freelance.
Explain to me how you do that networking when you want to find freelance work, because these rules apply to anybody.
Yes, it absolutely does. And, you know, my dad would laugh about this because he basically has been telling me this since as long as I can remember. And it took me a long time to really get it. But it really is all about the network. I mean, what you do when you talk to people is you talk about what you do and you talk about what you're working on and you talk about what you're interested in. And when you talk about your work and you're enthusiastic about it and you have ideas and you have plans and it just comes up in conversation, then sort of naturally from that, people will think of you when something that they're working on or something that someone they know is working on applies to what you do. I can't even tell you the number of times it's happened where just a conversation, just a casual conversation, has turned into work in that way. That either turns into something that I can then pass along to someone else or something that I can do myself, depending on what it is. And it really is all about those conversations. And they tend to be, I feel like people get so stressed about the word networking and they feel like it's so schmoozy and obnoxious. And it's, I really don't believe that it is. I really believe it's just talking about what you care about, assuming you care about your work, which is the idea, that, you know, the hope. And if that's the case, then it's just going to naturally come up, and then those conversations don't have to feel so painful. But you do have to put a little effort into making it kind of the front of a conversation, or at least an important part of a conversation, as opposed to just, you know, your kids, which is the other thing I talk about all the time, or a vacation you took or whatever. You do have to sort of put a little bit of effort into bringing up what you do.
Do you find any difference between a professional freelancer like you and people who are now freelancing as they look for a full-time job?
Yeah, well, my husband is doing exactly that. He is a teacher, and he was laid off in all these many, many layoffs in the education system. And for the first time ever, he needed some income and didn't have, you know, kind of a regular thing. And so he is not the freelancer type. He's, you know, he didn't really have an option. So we just sort of talked about different things that he as an educator could do as a freelancer. And he managed to get a bunch of homeschool classes going. And he's, you know, he had to put the word out there and do the networking and talk about what he does. And it is, at the same time, he's looking for full-time work. I don't think you can fully succeed as a freelancer if you're not really focused on doing it, but you certainly can do some freelancing while you're waiting for something more long-term to come through. I think many people want that stability and the security of a full-time job, but I absolutely think that you can freelance in the interim.
For those of us brave enough to be out there freelancing, one of the main hurdles is the loss of benefits.
Benefit insurance specifically is the big thing. I mean, that's something that makes me very frustrated. I had insurance through my husband's school, which was great. We had insurance for our whole family. I have two kids. And he lost his job and poof, like that's it. There go the benefits. And we looked into independent health insurance and it is obscenely expensive. COBRA is obscenely expensive. What we ended up doing is going with the Freelancers Union. Oh, sorry. No, I did that. I did Freelancers Union once before. This time we went with Fractured Atlas, which is another, it's group insurance for independents. So you get more like group rates even though you are an independent.
Right.
And it's expensive. I mean, there's no way around it. It takes a huge chunk out of what I make, and that's just that's just the way it goes. But it is more affordable than getting something just, you know, independent insurance through Blue Cross, for example. I mean, that just, to me, I don't know how anyone could possibly afford that. But it's tricky. And as far as the vacation time and the
weekend
sick days go, I mean, that, you know, that's sort of the good and bad of freelancing. You're kind of on all the time, but you can be off whenever you want.
Mia, have you had to learn to set limits in a way you didn't before? Are you one of those people who tends to overwork?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I am. Or yes, I can. I have a hard time turning it off sometimes. Like last time I went, we took a week-long vacation this summer, and I left my computer home because if my computer is near me, I will work. I just can't help it. I think partly because I like my work and I think about it a lot and I want to do it, and partly because I just feel obligated because I want to make sure I don't miss something. You know, as a freelancer, like if a job comes in, I want to be sure that I'm the first person to respond and that I'm, you know, on top of it. So if I don't want to work, I really will leave my computer behind or I'll leave my phone behind, and then I really can turn it off. As long as I don't have it near me, I can turn it off. You really have to be a master of planning your time to make it work as a freelancer.
Talk to me a little bit about Freelance Cafe. You've established a place where people with a certain set of skills can do virtual networking.
Yes, I have so many things I'd like to do with it. I mean, right now, all it is a website. It used to be a social gathering. In Oakland, we used to get together every month, and we called it Freelance Cafe, and basically any freelancers of any fields could kind of come out for drinks and just get together and talk about that stuff. And from there, I decided I had all these resources that I was just getting as a freelancer myself, you know, newsletters and job opportunities and grant opportunities, and I just wanted a way to share those with people because I felt like that's how I'm going to find work is by people sharing those with me. So, you know, in sort of good karmic fashion, I would put that stuff out there publicly in hopes that some of it would come back my way. And so I created this website where basically any opportunity that I came across, I would just post it up there. There's definitely some grants, for example, that just have dried up and are not available anymore. But at the same time, there's new ones that have cropped up. So I think just the more you look for that stuff, the more you'll find.
Mia Lobel is the founder of FreelanceCafe.org, a journalist and an independent audio producer, as well as an instructor at the City University of New York. Coming up, after natural disasters, we tend to forget quickly if we were on the sidelines. But if you were directly impacted, the fallout can last for generations. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1220. The rebuilding after Hurricane Sandy will be going on for months, maybe years. The sheer size of the storm has reopened conversations about climate change and has many of us rethinking our assumptions about our own safety. When Daniel Whaley was 13, he lived in Florida with his mother. Together, they rode out a hurricane. It's not often you get to hear what it was like from someone who's actually been through it. And Daniel Whaley of Youth Radio Vermont will tell you it can blow your life in a different direction.
I was living in Florida, Punta Gorda, Florida, a little bit north of Fort Myers. We were living in a small block house. It was white with a gray roof. It was a quiet little area, you know, nothing big happened. I was living with my mom, and of course she would have a few friends that lived with us from time to time, but during the hurricane we were living by ourselves. I've been living there for about 4 years. That was probably the longest place I've ever lived, and I was probably close to a lot more friends, being as we move from place to place, and like for 6 months we'll stay in one place, and then there's something wrong. My mom always has something wrong with the place, so we move again. I woke up that morning, and it was dark, very dark, unusually dark. I went out, my mom was sitting in the chair watching TV, and, you know, she had the Weather Channel on. And it just seemed so strange, you know, just my mom was confident, you know, that we could stay there and everything would be fine, nothing bad would happen. But then, you know, we figured out an hour before it came that it was getting bigger and stronger, and it was going to hit us directly. I was terrified. It was just horrible sitting there watching this huge hurricane come closer and closer to Florida on TV. I was 14. I was 14 years old at the time, and I was a scaredy cat pretty much. Everything scared me. And my mom was just like, calm down, calm down. It won't hurt us. You know, it's far away. It won't do anything. It was a category 4 hurricane. It was getting stronger. I was thinking she was a very courageous person for thinking that we could survive such a thing. But at the same time, I was thinking she was kind of a fool. She decided that we would go to the bathroom, the smallest room in the house, smallest window in the house, pretty much. And then we were going to wait in there. We had all the stuff in there. We had blankets, we had pillows, we had a mattress over the window. We were in there, and the wind started. All you could hear is the whoosh. You know it's coming. You know it's going to hit. You could hear tree limbs, you know, breaking apart and hitting the house. We had such crappy windows in the house that the wind was going through them. They were the ones you can roll up, and they were like separate little windows all together. and you could hear the wind going through those little windows. You can hear it rambling the bathroom door, like the entire house around that bathroom was destroyed, and the wind was just pounding at the door. But then it got worse. I heard this tree branch hit the window that was right above me, and the mattress flinged forward a bit, and then came back, and I felt the glass just go all over me in the bathtub, and the tree branch was sticking out of the mattress. It went right through the mattress, and I'm sitting there looking up at a tree branch, and then I looked at my mom, and she's standing there up against the bathroom door, you know. She just looked so dazed. She got down on her knees, and she was holding the door with her feet, and then holding the mattress above me with her hands, making sure nothing else came through. But then suddenly the wind just stopped, and it was just calm and quiet. We got out, and by then, of course, we didn't have power. Nothing was working in the house. We go outside, it's calm, there's no wind. No wind in the center of a hurricane. And you just look around and you just see all the devastation that's already happened. I mean, we looked across the street where one of the houses were, and I mean, there was this gigantic hole in one part of it, just this hole that something went through. And we went into my room, and we saw that one of my windows were broken. And we looked out the other window that wasn't broken, and we saw this gigantic tree right up against it, right on the roof. And the other one was ripped out, just ripped out the ground and everything with it. But then all of a sudden, you know, we started hearing, you know, the wind coming through the windows again, and it's starting to rumble up again. So we ran back to the bathroom and we shut the door. It was completely dark. It looked like midnight. So we pretty much figured out, you know, that there's another side to it. And we were just getting into the strongest area of the storm, and it was getting worse and worse. We started hearing trees falling apart. We started hearing like things hitting the roof. We kind of heard, you know, like people's houses. We could hear them just breaking apart. We actually, out of the window, we could actually see parts of garages just flinging in the wind, going everywhere. I mean, these huge trees just breaking apart and hitting the ground. We began talking about what we were going to do if we did survive this. Where are we going to go? What are we going to do? We don't have the money to go to a hotel. What is there to do? My mom, she was talking about moving again, you know. She was like, we can't stay here. If we're going to have hurricanes like this, we can't stay here, you know. And I was trying to convince her to stay because, you know, even if we're going to go through hurricanes like this, you know, at least have friends there, you know, that will be there after the storm. My mom was convinced about moving after that. That January, just disappeared. We kind of just packed up and left. We went to Tennessee to live in this small trailer in the middle of nowhere. We felt kind of the same what we did during the hurricane. Felt just lonely out there. My mom wasn't feeling good. She was depressed that she was living off unemployment, and it wasn't paying much. So we came up with a plan. My mom was going to go down to Florida. She was going to stay with a friend there, and she was going to try to get better so she can get a job and so that she can support me. And she was going to take me to my brother in Vermont, where I could get a job there, I can make some money, I could probably stay there for 2 years and finish off school. So she packed up all her stuff, you know, put it in storage, and went down with just a suitcase full of clothes and a dog and lived in Florida while I took a suitcase full of a few things that I wanted. And now I live in Rutland, Vermont.
That commentary was produced by Youth Radio Vermont. A natural disaster changed the life of a young Colombian reporter before she was even born. Dominique Lemoyne has been searching for her family's history, a history that was wiped out by a volcano. But that history, she believes, is shaping her future.
Growing up, My mom used to say she was from nowhere, that her childhood and her birthplace were wiped from the map. My maternal grandparents died on November 13, 1985, in what is still Colombia's most appalling natural disaster. Luis and Otilio Ulloa lived in Armero, a small but prominent agricultural town in the central western region of Colombia. At 9:09 p.m. that day, my grandparents, along with the entire town, disappeared after the eruption of the Nevado del Ruiz volcano that stood 30 miles away. I was born a year later, on October 30, 1986. Although I never met my grandparents, I've always felt like a part of me was gone too. This is why over the past 6 months, I've been trying to collect as many memories as I can of Luis and Otilia. I don't intend to rewrite history, nor pay them a tribute like fallen idols. My attempt is to understand who they were, build a memory of them for myself, and get a better grasp of my origins, of where I come from. I started off with the only photograph that's left of them, and have been working my way through the past. I've been looking for any piece of evidence that relates to my grandparents, and meticulously recording this information in a thick, leather-bound notebook. I've collected scraps of old Armero maps, and marked the different houses they lived in, newspaper clippings that listed their names as missing people, and a few pictures of my mother as a baby, sitting on the porch, or as a child celebrating her first communion. But most of all, my notebook is full of testimonies I have heard from my mother and other people who knew my grandparents, who were close to the family, or who were the last ones to talk or see them when they were still alive. I've learned that my grandparents owned a hotel and a bakery, that there were two fridges and two dining tables in their house, and that my grandmother used to give my elder brother baths in branded milk when he was a baby. I've also come to discover that Luis loved white linen suits and that Otilia wore red lipstick and dyed her hair until the day she died. All these memories are little pieces of a past that I didn't witness, but that, in many ways, are also mine. Like every attempt to seize lost time and define or understand oneself, it is incomplete and will remain so. But maybe it's thanks to this that it's no longer to me a mystery why my middle brother likes wearing white suits in warm weather, why my mother is so obsessed with the whiteness of teeth against red lipstick, why I happen to bake and love food, or why my elder brother's skin is flawless. The notebook has become a way not only to recreate a memory that has eluded me for more than 26 years, but a way to preserve it. With time, I've come to realize that I cannot expect to shape my future if I forget my history, even if it's just a fragile, fragmented one.
Dominique Lemoine is a Colombian writer and journalist interested in preserving family and cultural histories. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.